Coming to you live from Viva Las Vegas, it's The Hand Podcast, brought to you by Movie Changeup, where each week we kind of break down this week in streaming. We break down all your favorite platforms from Hulu, Amazon Prime, Netflix, Disney, plus all your other favorite streaming platforms. As always, I'm your host, Jill Fricke, brought to you with my co-host, as always, Tristan Mayer. And basically, we're going to tell you what's coming up on streaming, what streamed this last week, what you should watch, maybe what you should avoid. And then at the end of the episode, we kind of break down and determine what streaming service won the week. Last week, we kind of had a mix because we did our upcoming preview, and Tristan was so hyped by what was coming up on Peacock in the month of September. He gave the win to Peacock. I said, you know, between Hard Knocks, House of the Dragon, I had to stick with HBO Max. HBO Max has been winning most of the votes, but we'll see how it plays out from here. Tristan, kind of what was your overall impression? Was this a good week for streaming?
Yeah, I will say this week taught me one valuable lesson, Joe, and that was that it's very hard for me to pay attention to anything else while there's a Game of Thrones show airing at the same time. I was very much focused on House of the Dragon this week, but that didn't stop me from being very invested in all kinds of other stuff. This is a very stacked episode, you know, and it feels like a great conversation coming up because all of these different eras of fandom and different streaming platforms, like it feels like every platform is starting to kind of fire on all cylinders right now and kind of go for the meat here. So it's going to be a really meaty discussion, even though my mind was very much in Westeros. There was all kinds of worlds to talk about this week, so it's going to be a fun conversation.
All right, yeah, I'm excited. We'll get to that conversation eventually, but we will kick it off with Hulu. I know you watched a documentary about one of the great rock bands, Kiss, called Kiss Story. Tell me about that. How did you feel about it? Who should be watching that?
Yeah, Kiss is an iconic band. My dad grew up loving Kiss, and he passed that love along to me. If you don't know Kiss, you I'm sure know the look of Kiss. They're the ones who are famous for the makeup, you know, and the big tongue sticking out. I'm sure you know, Rock and Roll All Night and a couple of their Detroit Rock City, some of their bigger songs. And this is a two-part documentary, hour and a half each, so it adds up to 3 hours total. It's not quite the Beatles Get Back level length, but it is up there in length. But I think an hour and a half episode, two episodes each is perfect way to do it because you're really able to cover the whole journey of this band and you have enough time to do it, but you're not quite as long-winded as some of the other documentaries sometimes can be. I think the biggest problem is that it very much is like an A&E puff piece in a way of like it's hosted by members of the band and they're very much prominent parts of the documentary. So it's not necessarily going to get into all of the lows of the band or the kind of the deep kind of depths of maybe the lower parts of the career. It's going to touch on it. It's going to say, oh yeah, we did this when you were kids. You know, you're dumb kids, we did dumb stuff, but it's not going to go into all the detail that maybe a more objective documentary might. But if you're a fan of the band and you want to get some great stories and some great behind the scenes footage, it's a really fun dive into that, looking at the band. And if you aren't familiar with them and you just know kind of like their big hits and you're like, what is this band about? Who is Kiss? How are they more than just the weird cat makeup? You know, I think this will give you an idea of why that appealed to it and kind of like the camp of that and why giving that weird clash of the makeup with the heavy metal rock. And it really felt like the kind of juxtaposition of like things that should not go together clashing together. And it made a really fun band that was, even in its lowest points, I think very much aware of itself. And even in their like disco age, was very much having fun with the fact that they were Kiss and they were these kind of caricatures of a rock band. And this maybe have a little bit of appreciation for some of the lower points of Kiss's era. But yeah, I recommend it for sure, especially if you're a music fan and want to get us to dive into this band. I like it a lot. And two episodes, both on Hulu. I think they aired on A&E originally, but they're on Hulu right now to be streaming. So check them out.
All right. Yeah, I enjoy their music. I wouldn't go as far as to say I'm a fan. One of the few things I know about the band is I saw an interview with Gene Simmons where he said initially, and if you got kids listening or watching, tell them to close their ears for the next 30 seconds. But originally he wanted to name the band Fuck, and like their albums were just going to be like Fuck Me, Fuck You, Fuck Them. And I thought that was great. And basically their manager, the label, was like, you can't name a band Fuck. And so they settled on the much more PG version of Kiss. So.
Yeah, I think Kiss has definitely an influence on kind of the extremism. You know, there's a lot of music out there that's now like, let's just be as crazy and bizarre as possible. Let's call our band, you know, Mannequin Pussy. Let's make it the craziest name we can think of. And, you know, maybe Kiss had some influence on that. You know, they were the ones who were, now they didn't start that, of course, but they're like kind of the pioneers in a way of an era of like, let's be kind of extreme and exaggeration. And let's take these kind of tropes of this genre and blow it up to like 200%. And I love the band for that. And I think they had an influence on my taste overall, because I think I have come to grow into liking really kind of exaggerated and camp and overblown kind of things. And I think Kiss had an influence on that for sure. So this gave me some nostalgia for sitting in my basement when I'm, you know, 9 years old, listening to Kiss with my dad. I had a good time watching this.
All right. Nice. And another show I watched on Hulu this week was Welcome to Wrexham. I talked about it a little bit last week, but I'm not going to go a full review, just kind of a touch-up. Basically say that I'm still enjoying it. I thought the first two episodes were great. Second two episodes were great. So if you're a little leery, a little where, you know, hadn't quite got to it yet, it definitely hasn't dropped off yet. It wasn't one of those things where the first two episodes are really good and it kind of fell off after that. And if you didn't happen to watch last week, it's pretty much, I feel like, a Hard Knocks or All or Nothing, basically, about owning this very, very low-level soccer team. And it's actually now owned by Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. It kind of follows their journey of owning the team, and you kind of see certain things from the owner's perspective. Like, there was a scene where the new sod on the field didn't take, and the Ryan Reynolds was like, well, how much does it cost to replace? And it's like, well, we paid $100,000 the first time, and it's going to probably cost at least another $100,000 to replace it this time. And so now it's going to cost them $200,000 to replace the sod. And if they don't replace it, the chance of an injury is high. So they're like, well, I guess then we got to replace it. And I think it's just an interesting show. Not mine.
Yeah, you wonder sometimes when you see the prices of stadiums, you know, even like small stadiums, you're like, how did that cost so much money? And you're saying $100,000 just for the sod. I'm like, oh, maybe that's why they're spending millions, if not like $1 billion building stadiums, even on like a high school level.
Yeah, so I definitely, it's definitely a good show if you're a sports fan, if you're a fan of docuseries, or if you're just a fan of Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney, I would definitely check the show out if you haven't. And then I know another show that you watched, unless you wanted to bring up something, I know you watched one more thing on Hulu.
Yeah, I watched something on Hulu. I will check out that show eventually, Joe. I definitely am curious to see how involved they are in that too, because that's kind of the appeal, is like these celebrities going in and buying a team and being actually involved in the running of it. It almost sounds like a movie premise in its own right, you know? So that's kind of what I'm excited to see as you go along. But yeah, I watched The Patient on Hulu. It's one of those Hulu FX combination releases where it airs on FX and Hulu the same day. And this one stars Steve Carell. It's sort of a drama, comedy, thriller. I don't even know what to call it. Much more on the dramedy side, but there's a little bit of dry humor here and there to keep it on a little bit of a humor edge. But yeah, Steve Carell, he kind of wakes up disoriented. He's not really sure where he is in this basement, and he stumbles out of his bed and realizes that he's chained to the floor and he's been captured and kidnapped, and there's no way he's going to be able to escape. There's nobody around or no one can hear him. And we flash back from there to reveal that Steve Carell is a therapist. He's kind of going through his day-to-day life routine with his various patients, and we're focusing very specifically on Domhnall Gleeson, who you would know from Ex Machina, or from the new Star Wars trilogy. He played Hux in that. He was a handful of times in the new Harry Potter movie, or new Harry Potter movies, old Harry Potter movies at this point, as one of the Weasley twins, or one of the older Weasleys.
The most recent Harry Potter movie, not counting Fantastic Beasts, came out over 11 years ago. So.
Yeah, I say new Harry Potter movies as if they just came out. But in this, he's a very troubled patient. He's kind of, you know, socially isolated, doesn't talk to a lot of people, and having trouble opening up to his therapist, Steve Carell. And throughout this montage, we're also finding out that Steve Carell is kind of traumatized himself and has a bit of history with a wife who passed away, and he's kind of not dealing with that well. And by the end, by kind of halfway through this episode, you of course realize that Domhnall Gleeson is the one who has kidnapped Steve Carell, and you spend the first episode kind of building up to that inevitable confrontation of these two characters coming together and having that kidnap at the end. And then the premise is essentially that Domhnall Gleeson kidnaps Steve Carell because he says, look, I want therapy, I want help, it wasn't working for me, I want you to help me. I'm kidnapping you and I'm tying you here to this couch and you're gonna help me get therapy until I'm better. And that's that. And it's kind of very focused on these two relationships at first. And I'm curious to see how much it grows and how big it gets, because from the trailer that I saw in the theater recently, It does get at least wider in terms of adding in more characters. But as of these first two episodes, it's very much these two people in this room or maybe in the therapy office talking to each other. And from that, I'm curious to see how it kind of earns its runtime and makes it feel like it's worthwhile of being a show and shouldn't have just been like an hour and a half movie. But as of right now, I'm pretty into it, especially mostly for these two performances. And I'm curious to see how it goes and how far they are kind of are able to push each other, because Steve Carell, when he does drama, can do it really well. So I'm excited to see how far he goes here.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a modern day take on Misery. And I feel like that's not a story that you could really stretch out over a show. I feel like after three episodes, you'd be like, all right, like I get it. So I'm definitely curious if they're able to stretch that out over a show length.
Yeah, that's my biggest hesitation right now, because the episodes are only like a half an hour each anyway. So part of me is like, this feels like it's among those shows that was really kind of meant to be a movie. And they were like, well, people don't really watch movies like this anymore. So we got to kind of turn that into a miniseries and put it on a streamer platform, because maybe then we'll get an audience, you know. So I'm curious to see how, like I said, how it earns that weird runtime. Not only being a TV show, but having those half an hour episodes that make it kind of an oddity among, because it's a drama, but it's also having these half an hour runtimes, and it has a comedic actor at the front, but it's a very much serious performance. It's an odd show, but I love the oddity of it, and part of that odd tone and the weirdness and is what appealed to me and what is going to keep me watching and seeing how they wrap it up and make that worth the time that it's taking to tell the story.
All right, I'm definitely intrigued by it. I've seen commercials for it, also I'll definitely try and check it out. Anything else you watched on Hulu? Are you ready to move to one of our bigger conversations of the episode?
I'm ready to move on, but Joe, I want to reenact for you a scene before we move on from the patient here, just before we do, because they're going to start a conversation. He says, oh, one second, let me just take a sip here from my drink. Guys, I'm going to hold it up to the camera before I drink there, and then I'm just going to go, thank you, Steve Carell, for that drink. That was really delicious. Anyway, let's move on to the next topic. Let's go.
I'm really craving a monster right now for some reason, and I don't know why. I can't quite figure it out. All right, so let's move to one of our bigger conversations of the evening, one of the bigger episodes, one of the most expensive episodes of all time, if not the biggest, and that is the first two episodes of Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, set a substantially long time before the classic Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think because they didn't quite have the rights to the Lord of the Rings trilogy or a lot of the Lord of the Rings work, it's like wink and a nod supposed to be canon with those movies, but they can't officially say that. Like, they brought on Howard Shore to do the music. You look at the fonts and a lot of the stylistic choices in it completely lines up with those Peter Jackson movies, so I definitely think that's what they're unofficially trying to go for here. I don't know. I'm not a big Lord of the Rings Tolkien nerd. I've seen the original trilogy once, haven't seen the Hobbit movies at all. And so I don't know full-on timeline. I just know it's, like I said, quite a bit of time before. And the story, for the most part, follows Galadriel trying to take on Sauron. Like, Sauron killed her brother, and she essentially wants revenge. Like, it was his fight to take on Sauron, and he died, and so now it's my fight. And you're seeing a lot of these smaller characters, literally and figuratively, like the Harfoots. You're seeing another elf character. You're seeing multiple elf characters throughout the show. But Tristan, kind of what was your thoughts on the show? I know you're a lot more of a note taker than I am. It's probably why I walked out of college. But
yeah, I'm definitely an extensive note taker. I'm looking over my notes right now, and I have quite a lot, especially for somebody who has very little experience with Tolkien at all. A little bit more than you, I guess, because I have seen the Hobbit movies, and I made attempts through the years to read Lord of the Rings. It's never clicked with me very much. But I do respect Tolkien a lot for the influence he had on like creating the archetypes that we love. You know, Star Wars doesn't exist if you don't have Lord of the Rings to give him those archetypes to play with, you know. And I think this show had a big risk and a big uphill battle because of that. You know, it's based off something that was written so long ago that they have to make it feel relevant today when this has been taken and done in more modern ways in other shows, including one that is airing, you know, essentially side by side with it. You know, House of the Dragon is very much an extension of Tolkien lore in its own way. And not to say that's in the canon or anything, but it's like George Martin was very much inspired by Tolkien specifically. And this also had the uphill battle of just not looking that good. The trailers are not that appealing. For some reason, the photos I saw were not that appealing. And if you watched last week's episode, me and Joe were not very excited for this show. It was on our list, but not that high. And after saying all of that, I was super, super impressed by the show. I was honestly blown away by it. I thought the production value was just staggering. It was like almost every single shot was just mind-blowing to look at. And it was like the attention to detail with all the costumes and the sets and the just everything you saw on the screen just felt so alive and so detailed. And you compare that to Lord of the Rings and movies, and you look at those documentaries, and it's like the amount of thought they put into stuff that would be on screen for like 3 seconds, if even on screen at all. You know, they talk about the detail and the armor that was like not even shown on camera, but they put it in there just to add to the detail. And this feels the same way. It feels like they're doing stuff just because it looks cool. And I was so happy to see a studio be like, you know what, let's just make this shot cooler. You know, let's put more money into this to make it look cooler, rather than saying, let's make this cheaper. Let's pull off more money, less money, less money, less money. Make it as cheap as we can make it. That feels like the motto of some studios, but I was just thrilled. I was thrilled to see Amazon. You know, they've got the money for it. You're for all the choices you're making as a company, at least put some money into something that I can enjoy, you know?
And yeah, so your paper towel also costs a little bit more the next few months. It is what it is, you know?
Maybe it's worth it, you know? And for this type of show, I'm just so happy to see the money actually go onto the screen. We've seen so many expensive shows or expensive movies where you wonder where did that money even go, you know? And you can see where the money went in every single shot here. And that's just what I love so far about this show. What do you think so far?
I think I definitely enjoyed it. I saw a lot more hate on it on Twitter and social media, so I was going into it expecting it to kind of be like average at best or just kind of eh. But the first episode I watched, I'll be honest, I wasn't that into it. And then when the second episode hit, I was definitely more into it and more intrigued, and it's something I would watch even if we weren't doing this podcast where we had to review these shows. It's definitely something I'd watch on my own. And I like it. I like the storyline. My main problem is because I really don't know Tolkien lore at all, outside of the vague pop culture stuff, it's hard for me to follow or necessarily care. And I feel like part of the problem is I feel like I'm watching the prequels being released after I've already seen episode 9, where it's like the whole thing is about defeating Sauron, but I've seen Sauron be defeated in the shows or in the movies, and I know this show isn't really gonna ultimately get that far in the scope, I don't believe. And so at least with the Star Wars prequels, it wasn't so much the story wasn't we have to defeat the Empire, it was let's see how the Empire is created. And so part of me is like, I'm watching this going, why am I watching this show? Because I at this point, if the ultimate goal is to defeat Sauron and I know they won't defeat Sauron in this show, why am I watching this show? And then the other thing I think it's lacking is star power. Like, the original Game of Thrones wasn't filled with A-list actors, but you had Sean Bean, and Sean Bean was like the big face, especially in season one, that they marketed around. Even House of the Dragon, you got Matt Smith, a former Doctor Who, as kind of the big face that everyone knows. I feel like Galadriel seems like to be the lead. It didn't necessarily have to be Galadriel, but that one elf, I don't remember his Elrond. The guy that plays Elrond, I feel like maybe go with like a James McAvoy or someone slightly more known in that role. Or just, I think that's the one thing, especially when it comes to viewership, where this show could lack, is I feel like we aren't in the age of the movie star. The franchise is definitely more important. But when your franchise in pop culture is more eclipsed by Game of Thrones, when you have a Game of Thrones show running at the same time, I feel like if the viewership struggles, it will be because there was no real star power at all. Someone's face you can put on a poster that people can go, oh, I know that person.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Especially when you look at the Lord of the Rings movies, those had some star power for sure. People that you knew, faces that you knew. And if you didn't know them, they were like powerhouse actors and people who are really giving like powerhouse performances. And I haven't really seen like a powerhouse performance so far. In this show, granted, it's two episodes in, but there's nobody where I'm like, oh wow, that's an incredible character that I'm really attached to. I can't wait to see what happens to them, you know.
Yeah, I recognize two people, and that's Elrond, who is played by young Ned from two episodes of Game of Thrones, and the human woman that's in love with the elf, who was Barney's love interest in like three or four episodes of How I Met Your Mother. And those are the only people I even recognize at all.
Oh, I will say I saw Moifred Clark. I don't know if that's how you pronounce her. Moifred something along the lines of that. I'm sorry for pronouncing your name wrong, but you were incredible in Saint Maud, and you're also, she's playing Gladriel in this. She was a lead in Saint Maud, an indie horror movie from a couple of years ago. I was really impressed by her in that, and she was kind of my known face going into this. I said, okay, I know you, and I know Gladriel, or how you pronounce it in the movies.
You can keep talking. I'll be back in 1 second.
And I thought, you know, I know who this actress is. This is my one kind of known face going into this. And I love horror, so I was curious to see how she was going to translate here. And I like her a lot. She's giving a really good performance as Gladriel. It's very emotionally centered. It's very, like, intense. And I think that her character arc, for me, is what I'm really attaching to so far, because her character arc is the most straightforward. It's, my brother died, I want revenge for my brother who's died, you know? And I think that lets us have something to attach to beyond all the fantasy stuff, beyond all the elven stuff, beyond all the ancient realms and the, you know, the literal map of massive continents. You can say, okay, I connect to this person wanting revenge for the brother, and that's it. It reminds me a little bit of, okay, Frodo has a ring, he has to get it to the mount, and then it has to blow up, you know? So it's like, you give something for the people who were not at all into fantasy to attach to. And I think it helps a lot to have something like that for your through line, where it says, okay, she wants revenge for her brother. I understand that. I can connect to that one individual plot line, you know?
So one more thing I wanted to say, one other guy I recognized, I was like, I know his face. I don't know where I know his face. So I had to look him up, and that's, I don't know if it's the King Elf, but the leader of the elves, played by Benjamin Walker, who is the star of this cinematic classic, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
It's too far away. Can't go get it. It's in the closet, though. I got it right there.
It's legitimately a fun and entertaining film. Definitely not an Oscar contender in any category, but I enjoy it. It's fun. I've seen it quite a few times. And
the book is good, too.
So one of the things I looked up, I went on Reddit, I went to the kind of the Lord of the Rings subreddit after I saw the episode and saw like Lord of the Rings fans talk about it, and so I could get some information. So you know where one of my favorite storylines was when Elrond met his dwarf friend and their whole dynamic, I really enjoyed that. I thought that was fun. Do you know where that mountain is in Lord of the Rings lore, like where that pops up again?
You're saying the Dwarven Mountain, the one that it was in the Lord of the Rings, it's now abandoned and destroyed, and they go to see it, and he's bragging about how awesome this Dwarven city is, and they go and they show up, and there's nobody there because they all got killed in The Hobbit.
Well, it's in The Hobbit, and then it's also...
Well, it's not in The Hobbit, but it's in The Hobbit movies. Well, they did some retconning to put them stuff... I believe that's what happened. It's been a while since I saw The Hobbit, but... That was one of the controversial choices of The Hobbit.
Well, it's not in The Hobbit. That's where the Balrog is. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I saw that. That's where the Balrog is, and I wanted. That's really the only, like, Lord of the Rings lore thing I saw. That was like, oh, cool. On Amazon Prime, you can go and watch the movie and pause it, and they'll show you the actors that are on screen and what their character's name is. So when that guy landed on the ground, I was like, oh, who's this gonna be? And I paused it, and it just said the Stranger. So if you didn't watch the episode, a guy lands from like a meteor in front of these two Harfoot girls who are like not quite hobbits. I think they're smaller, and they hide from mankind. Any guesses on who this is gonna be, the Stranger?
Yeah, I'm curious about that, because that's definitely the big mystery so far, and. I have my questions of like, is this someone that we are supposed to know? I definitely not. It feels like the mystery box kind of like, okay, we're painting these various different answers. And my first thought is that it was going to be some kind of Sauron or some kind of evil bad guy, because the fire and the music all kind of is very ominous and very dark, and it makes me feel like it's going to be somebody who is eventually born to sinister intentions, and he has kind of an evil wizard look to him. I'm really curious to see who this is. My current theory, based on very little research into Tolkien lore and Tolkien characters and some of the different ideas of characters that this might be, is Radagast. You wouldn't necessarily recognize him because you didn't see the Hobbit movies, but he was played by Sylvester McCoy of Doctor Who fame in the Hobbit movies, and he's this slightly goofier older wizard who I believe in the Tolkien lore is only briefly offhand mentioned as being like a brother to Gandalf and not really prominent otherwise in the books, but that could be someone that I see them pulling because, like you said, they only have the rights to so much of the Lord of the Rings stuff. So someone that is only offhand mentioned, that's pretty ripe for them to do whatever they want to do with, as long as they're not treading into the movie territory. They can do whatever they want with that character, and it gives them a chance to be like, oh, it's kind of Gandalf but not Gandalf. You know, so they can do stuff without having to tie themselves to like a really, really, really iconic pop culture character.
So my theory, based on nothing, because I know nothing, is I think they're going to make everyone believe. Because I feel like when you spend $1 billion on a show like this, you're trying to make it as mass marketed as possible. So I don't really think it's going to be one of those things where it's like, who's this character? Who's this character? Oh, it's this guy barely mentioned in a book, which it could be. Shows do weird things I don't understand all the time. I think they're going to make us believe it's Gandalf and then reveal it's like Saruman or somebody.
Yeah, I think Saruman is the biggest theory going right now. For me, that was my first reaction. You see all the fire, you see the music, and that feels very ominous and evil. And yeah, it is interesting. Like, this is so far removed from Fellowship of the Ring, like 1,000 years or whatever it is from Fellowship of the Ring, but yet we're seeing more character crossover than we would have seen in House of the Dragon, which is only, you know, 100, 200 years before before Game of Thrones. But yeah, we have Galadriel, we have potential wizard characters showing up, crossovers, whoever this might be. We have, of course, Sauron. But yeah, I'm excited. This is not a show where I feel like I'm theorizing in any way. Like, I'm not sitting here saying, oh, what's going to happen next? Yeah. No, is she going to get her mission done? Is she not? But I'm just ready to see the adventure. You know, the next step of the cool visuals and the next step of the action, and see how it goes as it gets bigger and bigger. And as we get more focused on the characters, I think we'll become more emotionally attached. But as of right now, I'm very invested into this, and I'm surprised how much I liked it, because I was honestly ready to get on here and kind of make fun of it, almost, and thinking it was a obvious one-way win between House of the Dragon and this, but it's not nearly as easy as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I thought, for sure, for me, I thought this show was going to be, especially after the first episode, I was going to be like, yeah, Tristan, you can kind of review this on your own. I'm probably not going to keep up with it. But the second episode made me more interested. And for me, it's hard to theorize just because I don't know anything. Like, if this was a Star Wars show or even a Game of Thrones show, it's like, okay, I've seen Game of Thrones through at least, I've seen every episode of Game of Thrones at least twice. I've browsed a little bit of the backstory with Lord of the Rings. It's like, I barely know anything. So it's hard for me to be like, oh, it could be this guy. If it's not a main guy, then I don't know who it could be.
Yeah, I'm curious. This did inspire me a bit to begin my Lord of the Rings journey once again. I'll see how far I get into it. I'm going to try again to get through those books. And I've also heard that this is not exactly following the lore. Like, from people that I've listened to who are lore hounds, they'll say, like, oh, a 6 out of 10 generously in terms of accuracy to the lore. I've seen people give it, like, 4s out of 10 online. So I guess it depends how much of a purist you are. But it's interesting comparatively that I know much more about Game of Thrones. Like, I've read all those books a handful of times. I've seen the episodes a bunch of times. I'm above average in terms of knowing stuff about Game of Thrones characters. In terms of Lord of the Rings, I'm probably below average. Like, I can barely name to you the characters of the movies, let alone anything beyond that. So I'm excited for this because it's like a fresh perspective. I'm going into a world that I am familiar with, but I don't know much about, you know, so I'm just excited to see more of it. And if it keeps up this production value and this just completely gorgeous cinematography and the sets and the costumes all looking just incredible, this is going to be a contender for show of the year for me. Because in terms of craft, in terms of effort, this is just so far above anything that I've seen any of these platforms do. It's just kind of mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping, like, this and Andor, especially if it looks visually as good as the trailers do, just crush in viewership and awards to kind of force the rest. Because honestly, I care way more about Star Wars than I do Lord of the Rings. So I kind of hope it maybe forces Disney's hand to up the production value on their shows.
Yeah, I hope so, because, yeah, I mean, when you look at the comparisons, it's just...
not close.
It's laughable, you know? Yeah.
All right, so I think that kind of wraps up us on Amazon Prime. We can move over to Netflix. One of the shows I watched the first few episodes of, it's the next Netflix dating show, Dated and Related, where various sibling pairs move into a villa together. And they're all looking for love, and they're all kind of wingmanning for their sibling. You have brother-brother pairs, sister-sister pairs, and brother-sister pairs. My girlfriend and I watched it, and honestly, if the first episode were like, I'm kind of out on this, like, it's not anything special. But after the second episode, it started to click more of how they were doing things. Like, they had an elimination, and two, like, annoying girls, sisters, got kicked off. And they're, like, these two douchebag brothers. And spoiler alert that the girls got kicked off. But if you care about these type of shows, you don't really care if you get spoiled, because that's not what it's about. And they're like, all right, two douchebag brothers. They didn't call them that. I don't remember their names, but they're douchebags and they're brothers. They're like, you guys are going on dates. And they got super hyped and excited. But really, they were bringing in two new sibling pairs, a brother pair, both of them were brother-sister pairs. And they were going on dates with the brothers, and the brothers, all the guys were going on dates with the brothers, and the brothers had to decide who was going to be going on a date with their sister. And it was, like, fun, and I'm like, okay, I'm on board with this show now. I'm only about 3-4 episodes deep, but if you like the Netflix dating shows, definitely give it a check out. It's a lot more in the kind of Love Island vein than, say, a Ultimatum or Love is Blind vein. You're muted.
I'm glad you got this one for yourself, Joe. You know, yeah. I'm glad you got some reality shows to keep yourself fed.
Yeah.
But yeah, these are not my type of shows. We say more Love Island. That kind of intrigues me though, because I do love the reality shows that are just trashy people hanging out,
yep.
Trashing it up. You know.
Yeah, that's what this show is: trashy people hanging out, but they get to be with their trashy siblings. So
that makes it almost better. You know, mm-hmm. You're slowly but surely dragging me into this, Joe. If you tell me that it gets more and more ridiculous as it goes along, if you start selling me on some crazy characters, you might pull me in.
All right, maybe I will. Maybe I'll watch the rest of it this week and let you know. And I believe you watched another Netflix show this week, or documentary, Trainwreck, Woodstock '99.
I did. We talked about this in our preview show for the month. It was something that I was pretty excited about, because I have a lot of fun with concerts. I've been to so many concerts, and I've seen a handful of concerts, you know, going out of hand. I've been to, I could tell you so many different stories about concerts that I've been to where people fell apart and kind of crashed the stage. I have a horror story. I won't name the band for this one, but I will name the band for a different one. But for this one, I was at the meet and greet, and we waited in line in the heat for hours and hours, and they were late. They were so late. They were hours late. And...
No, he went away. All right, so Tristan's gone. When he comes back, he can talk about Dated and Related, and I, for now, will talk about the 30 for 30 I watched on Netflix called Year of the Scab. It basically... Oh, Tristan's back, so when he's done, I'll talk about Year of the Scab, but for now, he can finish up his talk of...
Speaking of horror stories, but yes, I've had bands show up hours and hours late, and then they show up to the meet and greet, and they start complaining, saying, looking right in the face, and they say, dude, this sucks. And then you're at the concert, standing in the aisle, and you get hit in the face by your beer bottles, and you're covered in beer, and there's big brawls out in the middle of the aisles, and people are tackling each other, and you're like, this is not the concert I thought I was going to, you know? And one of those times where they shine up the lights on the crowd, you look around and you're like, how am I living? Like, this is not a crowd I should be in right now, you know? I've also had a horror movie concert where I'll name this person because he's a celebrity that people know. And this is not the worst thing anyone said about Jared Leto, but I was at a 30 Seconds to Mars concert once in high school, and Jared Leto threw a very large fit because there was a huge, huge storm, right? Like a tornado level storm nearby, and it had blown the barrier down, and people had charged the the concert and kind of flowing over the stage, and not over the stage, over the chairs, and like everyone had kind of crowded up in front of the stage, and they were telling him he had to get off the stage, and we're cutting you out. You got like 10 more minutes left, play one more song. And instead of playing a song, you spent those 10 minutes ranting about how he's a rock star. He shouldn't get kicked off the stage. He should play as long as he wants to play. He's Jared Leto. You know, he's the headliner. Why are you kicking him off the stage? People in the crowd start booing him. People are telling him, just play a song. You know, the band's looking at him like, what are you doing? But no, he had to get his heart heard, you know? And none of those stories are anywhere close to Woodstock 99, but those are definitely some of my more memorable concert stories. I think Jared Leto, you know, his, I don't mind calling him out for one bad day of his life, but.
Yeah, he's definitely earned it at this point.
Yeah, but Woodstock 99 is a whole new level of disaster. If you don't know about Woodstock 99, they've made a handful of attempts to revive the iconic classic 1979 concert, Woodstock, and it's never quite happened. They did it in 97, and it happened, but it was a disaster. It was one that I mentioned last week that was all muddy and covered in mud, and people were sliding around and throwing mud pits at each other, and not a great concert to go to. But Woodstock 99 was even worse. You know, it reminded me this documentary a bit of Action Park, the one on HBO Max, that was about this kind of like free-for-all mad park that kind of turned into like the downfall of human nature and people getting in fights and hurt and all that kind of stuff. And this is very much a documentary about everything falling apart. It reminds me of the Fyre Festival documentaries too, where it's like all of these ideas that were not planned out or thought out at all, where they said, okay, we're going to rent out an airbase, you know, because Woodstock 99, they rented out an airbase and held the concert on this airbase with literal fighter jets sitting around and everything, you know. And that was not safe at all, to have like drunken teenagers surrounded by fighter jets and like military weaponry. Probably not a good idea. It also, I think, examines some of the larger scale problems, not just on like how did this event that was formed for peace and love and getting along and music slowly turn into chaos and fires and brawls, but it's also about like how has the counterculture, conversation and movement changed over the decades between 1979 and 1999. There's this very big difference in terms of media, in terms of what people consume and how people behave, and the demand for attention. We just talked about reality shows. People, when there's a camera around, they know they want to act up, they want to act cool, they want to put on a personality. And Woodstock 99 was a pay-per-view event. There was cameras all over the place, and people said, oh, I'm going to act crazy so they'll see me on TV on Woodstock 99. It almost feels like a birth of this reality show influencer era at the turn of the century, here, where the technology was becoming a part of everyone's everyday life, you know, in a different way than they were used to. So it's really fascinating just at that core level of watching this concert fall apart, but also I think on a larger cultural level of seeing how people have changed and how the counterculture has changed between the hippie movement of peace and love and happiness, and then kind of like the angry burn and destroy everything kind of movement of the late 90s. I really am liked this a lot. It's short, only a couple of episodes, so it's an easy one to binge through. And if you're into music history, there's a ton of great artists in this, like James Brown, and the artists that performed at this festival are all in the documentary too, so you get that music history side of it. So I think you enjoy that too. I recommend this a lot for anyone who wants to learn a bit more about this event, or who is just generally into like culture history, even if not just music history, but like the history of culture. Yeah, I like this a lot, and I highly recommend it.
Right, yeah, definitely sounds interesting to me. Definitely the type of thing I would watch. I saw it, and I had the choice between watching this and something else we'll talk about later this evening, and I chose the other thing. Another thing I watched this afternoon that was on Netflix that if you're a football fan, definitely check out is the 30 for 30 Year of the Scab. I believe it came out in 2018, and it essentially covers the 1987 strike, where the players wanted free agency and the owners were like, no, once we draft you, we want you to be part of our team until we don't want you anymore. And the players are like, but if I still got years left in me and you don't want me to play, you know, that kind of ruins my ability to get money. And it pretty much focuses on the Washington Redskins, because they were the only team that stuck together and stayed together and didn't have anyone crossed the picket lines the entire time. And, you know, if you've seen the Keanu Reeves movie, The Replacements, that's basically a fictionalized version of what happened. And I didn't even know they did a 30 for 30 on it. And when I was scrolling through Netflix today, I just wanted to check it out. And it's definitely entertaining if you're especially with football. Starting this Thursday, if you're a football fan and you haven't watched it, and maybe you're a newer fan, definitely check it out. It's a very interesting piece of sports history, and you'll want to throw your remote at the TV by the time it's over.
I've seen The Replacements, so, you know, I have that connection.
Yeah, Replacements, good movie. I have an idea for a Replacements sequel starring Keanu Reeves, but I don't want anyone to steal my idea, so I'm not going to tell that.
Hire Joe Studio. Well, I don't even know what studio owns that. Warner Brothers, probably? Warner Brothers Discovery?
Probably, something like that. And I also know you checked out season one of Cobra Kai. I know that we're about to get season five coming out soon, I believe. What are your thoughts on Cobra Kai so far?
Yeah, as I mentioned in our preview of September, I had watched the first episode of this when it first dropped way back in the day on YouTube Red, and it was like, oh, watch the first episode of Cobra Kai for free to check out YouTube Red. And I said, oh, sure, why not? And I thought it was fine. It never connected with me or anything, and I never really went back to it. And I've heard nothing but good things for literally years and years at this point about this show. So I said, you know what? Mainly from Joe. But I said, you know what? Joe has been bothering me about this nonstop. He's just so annoying about it. You know, every morning I wake up and there's text from Joe saying, have you seen Cobra Kai yet? Have you seen Cobra Kai yet? I said, fine, I'm going to appease Joe and I'm going to watch Cobra Kai. So I watched nearly the entire first season of Cobra Kai. I have, I think, 2 episodes left out of the first season. So I've been doing a bit of a binge. So like I said, it's hard for me to focus on anything that's not Game of Thrones. But somehow I found a way to watch an entire season of Cobra Kai nearly in that time. So I'm really liking this a lot, though. And I don't have any real attachment to Karate Kid, so it helped me a bit the first episode very much. It's like, remember Karate Kid? This is what happened in the movie. Here's the plot points. And I was like, all right, I would be annoyed about this if I was in my normal brain where I'm like, oh, it's just showing scenes from the movie. But it was like, I haven't seen this in so long. Like, I needed scenes from the movie because I was like, I remember that Johnny fights the guy and then he kicks him in the face and then he loses. And I don't remember much else about the movie, but yeah, it helped me to kind of bring me back in. And I thought it was a really, really great choice to not have the Danny be back as the lead in the hero necessarily. You know, I think it's a really genius almost choice to be like, no, let's kind of take the bad guy, the one that everyone, you know, sure, he was a victim in some of the scenes, but he was the bad guy of Karate Kid, you know, and let's make him the hero. And I thought it was really fun and really well done. And it has very much the camp that I mentioned that in the Kiss section. I like stuff that's kind of exaggerated and taking itself just a bit over seriously. And this has that, where like the first action scene is Johnny, like this fully grown man, like an alcoholic outside of the store fighting like a whole group of teenagers and like saying one line as he's beating up like a 17-year-old. And I was like, oh, this is my kind of show, you know. And the whole show has moments like that where they're just taking this children's karate thing very, very seriously. And when he first reunites with Danny, they still have these grudges that they from when they were like 15 years old that they clearly have not gotten over. And they think about like every single day of their entire lives. Like, this was just very much fun. I know, Joe, you've seen this, so what are your thoughts on the early goings of Cobra Kai? How are you feeling about me finally getting sold on the show?
Yeah, it's definitely good. You know, I think the early seasons were the best, but it's definitely still holds on strong, I feel, for the rest of the show. One thing you may not like is, I think as the series progresses, Johnny Lawrence takes a like further and further back seat. And it's, I mean, I think the show ultimately is about the kids at the end. The kids in Cobra Kai, I feel like, take more of the front seat, and Johnny takes kind of a step back, but he's still a very prominent part. He's still in pretty much every episode. The one thing I would say, I feel, though, is before you get pretty much anything past season 2 and maybe into season 2, I would try to watch the like Karate Kid Part 2, like the first 3 Karate Kid movies, because they bring back characters from those movies, and I don't feel like those moments will hit the same or matter the same if you haven't watched those movies.
Yeah, I was curious where if I should be filling in those sequels, because I had heard this a handful of the characters show up again, so... Yeah, now that I'm into season 1, I probably will go and fill in the sequels a bit more, because I have literally no idea what happens in the sequels. I know they're not very beloved, so I avoided them for my life. But, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that I watched a really disliked sequel and was like, that was great, actually. So I'm down to check out the rest of Karate Kid.
All right. So I think that pretty much wraps up our what we watched on Netflix. You know, we talked about everything else. I think I broke the news last week, Umbrella Academy, fourth and final season, and Resident Evil has been canceled after one season, and never seen an episode of Umbrella Academy, and apparently Resident Evil sucks. So
Resident Evil, I love the IP. I'm a huge Resident Evil fan, but
the show.
Nothing about that show appealed to me. Yeah. Like, I didn't even think about watching it. Like, at first I thought, oh cool, a Resident Evil live action series, that's going to be so awesome. And then you hear Netflix, and then you see the trailer, and it's like the most Netflix produced, like Netflix lighting, Netflix like sets, and it's like nothing horror in this trailer. So just from the trailer alone, I was like, oh, never mind, like I'm not watching this. And apparently I made the right call. But Umbrella Academy, I'm glad it's getting its final season, because I know they've been struggling with the ratings a lot, and I was kind of expecting them to get canceled. So the fact that they're going to get a chance to wrap up the story, yeah, because I know they have a passionate fan base, if not a large one. So I'm happy for them that they get to end their story. And I know I love Gerard Way. I love My Chemical Romance. And he's attached to that. You know, maybe he'll come back. And he created the comic book and wrote a lot of the issues, if not all of the issues, for Umbrella Academy. And I'm not sure how involved he is in the series, because I made attempts to watch Umbrella Academy, never made it very far. But now that it's the final season, I might make an excuse, because the fact that it actually will have an ending kind of appeals to me. It makes me want to watch it more, because there's nothing worse than watching a show like that that's very like plot and character focused, and then it just ends, you know? So if this gets good reviews, I'll definitely be watching the rest of the whole entire run of the series. If it gets mediocre to bad reviews, I'll probably just let Umbrella Academy be one of the shows I don't watch.
Yeah. All right, and I think that kind of wraps up Netflix and alludes to Disney Plus. We got a Pinocchio trailer last week. That movie looks garbage. I think I talked about that last week. I think we just forgot to erase the news section of our document that we run off of.
I'm curious to see that Pinocchio movie, man. It does not. I mean, who are these for? It reminds me of Lady and the Tramp dropped, I think, on launch day of Disney Plus, and I've never heard anyone mention that ever in my life until.
Have you ever watched it?
This is going to be one of those.
Have you ever watched it?
No, I've never watched it.
It's horrendous. It's so bad. So one of the people I was living with at the time wanted to watch it, and I could tell. I'm like, this is going to be bad. It was the worst thing I've ever seen. It was horrible. If we were doing like a top 10 worst streaming movies you've ever seen, it may be like top 5. And it wouldn't
Robert Zemeckis has to be up there among like biggest drop-off directors.
Yeah.
Like, the man directed so many high quality all time movies. Now he's directing like the most studio schlock stuff. It's really depressing.
It looks so bad. Like, I kind of want to do like a drunk watch along when it comes out.
I'd be down to do that.
All right. So me and Tristan kind of talked, with all these shows coming out, that our review of She-Hulk is kind of going to be the same every week. So unless some big important moment happens or the episode upticks in quality, we'll probably just wait and do a season review at the end, because our review every time is just like, it's fine, it's okay, it's solid, it's just another MCU show. It's not the worst one, but it's also not the best one. So there's our discussion of She-Hulk night this week. If you don't,
I will say though, if you stay after the credits, Joe's gonna twerk for you, so yeah. Stick around.
Yeah, so if you don't hear us talk about She-Hulk next week, that's why, really. Tristan did, however, watch the making of Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness. So is there any reason to watch that? Because every single making of that they've done for every Marvel project is, we had so much fun, it's amazing. Also, here's 10 minutes about one random department. So what random department did they focus on for this episode?
Well, they focus very much on the costume department in this, and how they specifically designed the costumes of the various variants in the movies to kind of show the difference between the universes. And they mentioned how, I think they call him Defender Strange. I can't even remember the names of the alternate Stranges in this version of the movie. The one that he has the final confrontation with at the end, who's living up in that dark tower with the eye on his head, you know. They talked about how his costume was the same costume worn in Endgame, but it was very much aged and decayed and kind of beaten up, and that made me appreciate it a bit more because it was kind of like, oh, Endgame went badly for this Doctor Strange, and he's never gotten over that, so he still has pretty much the same costume as Endgame, but it's all decayed and worn down and burnt up and stuff like that. So little moments like that do help me to appreciate this. But the reason that I do really enjoy watching all of these behind-the-scenes things is that they clearly don't talk to the editing team about like what they want it to look like or like how they want it to feel. And every single one of them feels completely different from the other one in terms of how it's edited or like what it looks like or the tone of it. And I literally have no idea what I'm going to get when I click on it. Like, is this going to be highly produced? Is it going to look terrible? You know, there's a saying in Game of Thrones where every time a Targaryen is born, they flip a coin. And I feel like every time Marvel releases a behind-the-scenes documentary, you flip a coin. It's either going to be some really highly produced, great one, like Ms. Marvel had a really, really good behind-the-scenes documentary, or it's going to be Bruce Campbell standing around with a bunch of, like, fake mirrors behind him talking about how Sam Raimi is just such a cool guy, you know? He's such a great director, and he was so open to his cast, and, you know, he's so stylish, and he has his Sam Raimi-isms, and we're going to do a little montage of the Sam Raimi-isms from the movie, and it was so much fun to be in this movie. Let's do a montage of everyone, like, laughing, you know, hanging out, doing cool stunts and stuff. It was so fun and cool. Let's make it sound like Liz Olsen really enjoyed the arc here. Let's somehow edit around her interview so it makes it sound like she was totally into this villain turn for Wanda, you know? And this is one of the lower end in terms of production value and also in terms of quality of the content. Like, in terms of actual learning about the movie, I did not learn much. I mentioned stuff about the costumes kind of helped me appreciate some stuff, but other than that, it was the director, I mean, either the director or the writer or Kevin Feige sitting there being like, and this scene is great because it's when Doctor Strange meets America Chavez. And then they cut to the scene and it's Doctor Strange meeting America Chavez. And they're like, oh, that was really insightful. Thanks for that, Kevin. I'm glad you were there for that.
Yeah. No one else could have introduced that scene like Kevin did.
One thing that I thought was very funny, though, is they got to the Illuminati scene, which was infamously disappointing for a lot of Marvel fans, I would say. I thought it was fine and fun and goofy, but people who were really, really invested in who are the cameos going to be and how cool it's going to be when they show up and that kind of thing, I think were disappointed by it. And they talked to the screenwriter, and he says the main motivator behind that scene was that, well, we're halfway through the movie and nothing's really happened yet, so something's got to happen.
I saw something that was on TikTok of all places of like what would have made that scene better, and instead of just doing a bunch of like fan cast to placate fans, if they had been like essentially made that the Illuminati like an evil Avengers team, and they had brought those people in, if you had brought in Tom Cruise as what's it, ultimate Iron Man or something like that, something like
Iron Man Supreme,
something like there's like Big this Mac, ultimate Iron evil Man. Iron Man. So you do that, you do Edward Norton as there's like this evil Hulk, so you bring Edward Norton back as this evil Hulk thing, you just give him a truckload of money, and then you essentially do like the evil version of the Avengers. So it's the Avengers we all know. It's not like, oh, here's a random John Krasinski as Mr. Fantastic to placate people who've had that theory forever. And it's just like, it actually ties into the MCU we've been watching and not just random fan cast. Because if you're not someone who like sits around on like Reddit all day looking at fan cast, John Krasinski as Mr. Fantastic doesn't really do anything to you. And then if you are and you're watching that scene, it immediately takes you out of the movie because you're just like, oh, they just placated us. That's nice. Even if you enjoy it, even if you were clapping in that moment, in the back of your mind, you were still like, oh, they're just placating us. It really has nothing to do with the story.
Yeah, I think what I really learned from this behind this documentary, something that kind of lurked behind the scenes of this behind the scenes documentary, is that I think COVID and the shutdowns and the reschedulings around that really, really essentially killed this movie, because they do talk for a bit about, they show some concept art and some ideas of what they were going to do before they had to adjust to their COVID shutdowns and the new procedures for that. And then they say, well, we had these ideas. And then things changed, and they kind of show how they had to adapt. So that was one interesting part, I guess. You get to see how they adapt to filming within restrictions of COVID times. And I think that's always interesting because it's such a unique specific point of history that it's kind of interesting to see how every different studio and production has their own unique way of adapting to make it look as good as they possibly can under the restrictions they had to work under. And I do wonder what Marvel looks like if they didn't have that necessarily. Like, of course, that's not the biggest issue that COVID has caused. But I think if we can travel to the multiverse and find some multiverse where this did not happen the way it did, maybe we look at like a totally different MCU. The movies come out in a different order. They come out a bit more as planned, a bit more highly produced. I wonder if we're in a much more like positive state of mind because Marvel's really kicked off the multiverse saga with a big bang rather than like this somewhat okay whimper.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wish they would talk about that. I wish they would just straight up be like, yeah, so we had like Tom Cruise lined up to come in and he was going to come in and play essentially evil Iron Man or whatever. And then COVID happened and he didn't want to leave his film set. So we weren't able to get him. And that got cut, and then we just replaced it with nothing and nobody. Like, we just stuck with what we had filmed and pieced it together. And the same way with, they're not going to say it, but I wish they would come out and say in the Obi-Wan, Making of Obi-Wan documentary that's coming out on September 8th, like, yeah, we were going to film this whole thing pretty much on location, and then a big COVID spike happened, and we couldn't. We had to film it in front of the volume. And so that's why, like, 90% of the show is filmed in front of the volume. But they're not going to say that. They're not going to come out and say that. They're just going to be like, we had a great time. It was fun.
Yeah, I would really respect these a lot more if they were just open about it, because I'm not going to judge them. It's a huge production. You're making big multi-billion dollar calls and stuff is going to happen and stuff is going to go wrong. But I think Marvel is, and Disney as a whole, but in particular, Marvel is like so protective of their brand, and they don't want anything. Like, this is, because if they go and they say, oh, we're going to do Ryan Reynolds, we're going to do Tom Cruise, we're going to do, you know, the cast from Fantastic Four, Roger Corman production of the 90s, but we couldn't, you know, then that is kind of out there forever, you know, and if they do that again, people are going to be like, oh, well, you already talked about it, it's not that cool, you know, so now they don't talk about it now, because if they do that in 10 years, they want it to be cool, yeah. You know, and when they bring Deadpool back and they bring Tom Cruise in for Secret Wars and Ed Norton in for Secret Wars, they didn't want to blow it in the Doctor Strange Decoded or whatever this is called. They want to keep that secret even for when they don't use it, you know. It's just very much kind of guarding something that isn't even being attacked.
Yeah. Also, before we move on from Disney Plus, one thing I wanted to say is I love how all these people are like, how are they going to do a Deadpool movie? He's like meta and self-referential. How's that going to work in the MCU? And She-Hulk does it. She's done it in every episode and no one cares. I have not seen that once as a complaint of like, oh, that ruins the MCU. Like, why aren't the other characters, like, no one, they just watch it, they enjoy it, and they move the fuck on with their lives.
Speaking of, I'm going to throw out a crazy prediction before we move on from Disney Plus, and that I think Deadpool shows up in She-Hulk. Okay. Maybe in the finale, maybe in the final post-credit scene, but I think it's the perfect tone, the perfect place for Deadpool to all of a sudden pop up and be like, holding a dead body or something, be like, oh, I need a lawyer.
Oh, that would be great. Like a post-credit scene, final post-credit scene for She-Hulk is Deadpool shows up with a dead body and says, I need a lawyer.
Look, I'm not saying it here now, so while we're not covering it, I have it out there for the internet points. You know, I got to get those delicious points when we come back and I can tell you I told you so.
All right. Anything else you want to say about Disney Plus or the making of Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness?
Nothing on Disney Plus. Looking forward to Andor. Only a couple weeks.
All right, and I don't remember if I talked about it on here or not, but we're moving on to HBO Max, and I just wanted to say, with all the content and all the stuff we have to cover, we're just going to, as much as I love the Detroit Lions, I got a Detroit Lions stuff hanging up all over this room, we'll just do the season finale wrap of Hard Knocks next week when it comes out. Granted, we're still probably going to have a lot to talk about, but it is what it is. We'll just do a finale wrap-up next week. I'm enjoying the show. If you're a documentary fan, if you're a football fan, check out Hard Knocks. And that brings us to a thing that's not an HBO Max original, but it did drop on HBO Max this last Friday, I believe, September 2nd. And that is Elvis, the Baz Luhrmann directed Austin Butler starring biopic about Sir Elvis Aaron Presley. Don't know why I called him Sir. He's not British, but I didn't see this movie when it was in theaters. I know Tristan did, and I rather enjoyed it. It was somewhat of a cradle the Grave biopic, but ultimately just covered, for the most part, his older years, and I feel like the movie should have just stuck with that. Here's what my prediction right now, I'm laying it out on the table. Austin Butler wins the Oscar for Best Actor. Tom Hanks wins the Razzie for Best Supporting Actor.
I like that prediction.
I feel like Austin Butler, Baz Luhrmann, everybody else was on the same page. If we're going more Romeo and Juliet Baz Luhrmann, where Tom Hanks is going more Moulin Rouge Baz Luhrmann. Like, he was just not in the same movie as anyone else in that movie. I feel like maybe, like, Tom Cruise, obviously great actor, one of two men to win the Best Actor Oscar back-to-back, but he was just in a completely different movie than everyone else. Maybe he needs to fire his agent between doing this, which I think was a poor choice for him, playing Geppetto in the upcoming Pinocchio movie. He's just not on a good run right now. But I enjoyed the movie. For me, I think ultimately the movie would have been better if it really only just focused on his later years, especially his Vegas run. I felt it was overly long, and I didn't really... Well, I understand a lot of the fact that he stole music from black artists is, like, an important part of his story. I didn't really feel like it was an important part of this story. I feel like this story was about how he got screwed over and railroaded, and basically kind of what the movie tried to suggest is the reason he died was because of Colonel Tom Parker. And I feel like a lot of the stuff early in the movie didn't really matter. I feel like you could lop off the first 45 minutes of this movie and you really don't lose anything as far as the message. But I feel like everything after that 45 minutes, I was all on board. I love the style of it. It's definitely, if you're a Baz Luhrmann fan, I feel like you will enjoy this. If you're an Elvis fan, I definitely would suggest checking this out. If you don't really know Baz Luhrmann's movies or style, you may find it a little too stylistic, a little too vibrant, a little too out there for you. But Tristan, I know you saw this movie in theaters. I don't know if you've watched it super recently, but what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I was happy to see this in theaters because I knew it was going to eventually come to streaming, and I caught it kind of at the tail end of its theater run because I knew it was going to be Baz Luhrmann. It was going to be very stylish and very colorful and very vibrant, and I thought, you know what, that fits the theater. You know, I want to go be overwhelmed by this movie, and I was overwhelmed by this movie. It's so much, and it's so much just blind flashing consumption and lights, and I think it perfectly feeds into the Elvis arc. It feeds into, like, they took this aw shucks kind of guy who just wanted to, like, sing covers of songs he liked, you know, and they dragged him into, like, this world of consumption and greed. And he was, and it's just, as he gets more and more pulled into this, the side of his arc, you know, this consumption side, and the film kind of itself explodes into its own kind of overwhelming editing, overwhelming cuts, split screens, flashing colors. And I thought it was just such a great watch, and you really feel like you're flying through this in the same way that Elvis is, just being dragged along and thrown from one place to the next place, and all of a sudden you're on stage performing in front of a huge, smashing, screaming crowd, and then you're just, like, whipped to the next area, and you feel that kind of disorienting, lost kind of vibe that I imagine they're going for with Elvis's character arc here. Like you said, he was just kind of used by Parker here, but I think Parker in the movie is a representation of not just himself, but of, like, capitalism and consumerism as a whole, and it just kind of tore Elvis apart, and people wanted more and more and more and more, and just their one little tiny piece of this greatness, and they took and they took and they took, and then eventually it was too much, you know. And I think it was that the movie really tells that, not just in the arc, but in the filmmaking itself. It just becomes so much to the point where you can't even take the style anymore, and then it puts you in that same headspace, you know. You feel like you're getting overwhelmed yourself by the blaring lights and the music and everything. I thought it was incredible. I think, yeah, you're right. I think Austin Butler wins an Oscar here. I think Baz Luhrmann gets a nomination, potentially wins. I think there's going to be a big race for director this year. Actor, not so much. I think actor is going to be between between Austin Butler and Brendan Fraser, now getting a lot of praise for The Whale in the last day or so. I think he could go for a run for the actor, but I think it's going to be those two. And I think if it's Austin Butler, he deserves it for this role. It's transformative. He, like, really, really becomes Elvis. People say that all the time, But this is not like a Bohemian Rhapsody kind of impression. This is like he becomes a character, you know, and I thought it was incredible.
Yeah, I think the two best biopic performances in my life as far as like forgetting that that's not the person on screen is Jamie Foxx as Ray Charles and Austin Butler as Elvis Presley. I feel like are the two that you watch and you forget, like, that's not the person. Like, I think Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash gave a great performance, but I feel like partially he looks so different that you can never look at that and be like, that's Johnny Cash. Where I feel like Austin Butler with the makeup and the performance and everything, you look at that and you're like, that's Elvis Presley.
Yeah, it's a great, great performance. And I think even if you're not a fan of Elvis, I recommend this because not to say I'm not a fan of Elvis, but you know, I'm not a big Elvis fan. You know, I know the songs that are popular, but I've never sat there and been like, oh, I'm gonna listen to an Elvis song right now. I'm gonna pull up an Elvis album. Elvis has never been a part of my listening or a part of my life in any way at all. And I still love this. And a lot of this was new information to me. I didn't necessarily know anything about a lot of these events, and I don't know how much of it was true. I'm sure a lot of it was not true. But that was kind of the fun of it. I was able to be thrown into this totally new thing, and with no history with Elvis, I was still able to get tons of joy out of it. And I think sometimes the problem with biopics like this is if you don't already know these events, you're not really getting much out of it. I think Bohemian Rhapsody had that problem, among other problems, but that was one of the problems I had, where if you aren't pretty invested in Queen and know what Live Aid is and know what Bohemian Rhapsody is, this is you're not going to work in any way for you. But I think this works for you even if you don't know anything about Elvis. You're just seeing a kid grabbed from the South and thrown into this crazy life of consumerism.
Yeah, so I kind of looked it up after I watched the movie. Basically, some of the events specifically aren't too, but a lot of the spirit of it is very much true. And I feel like ultimately when you're condensing a life of 40 years down to 2.5-hour movie, you got to change things to make things work. And I feel like I don't feel like at any point that they really like explicitly lied and made you be like, oh, well, like none of that happened at all. And then another thing I wanted to point out, to give credit to Baz Luhrmann, I thought the mixing, one of the things Baz Luhrmann always does is, especially when telling older stories, is mixing classic, well, not classic, but mixing modern music with kind of like the old style of stuff. And like there was a moment where there was a montage going on where it's introducing you to all the new people in Elvis's life. And it's kind of when he first moves to Vegas and it's playing Viva Las Vegas. And perfect, like, and I'm someone who loves music mashups of like this song mashed up. Perfect mashup of Viva Las Vegas and Toxic by Britney Spears. And you think about it, it's like, oh, a singer from Memphis who became a massive worldwide sensation, abused by her manager and her parents. Yeah, that definitely has no connection to the Elvis story, but a guy from Memphis who was launched into superstardom, worldwide fame, and abused by his father and manager. And then also In the Ghetto is the first song of the credits. The second song of the credits is a song Eminem recorded for this movie, and it's like if you're talking about Elvis, a white guy who got popular doing black music, and then you get Eminem, a white guy popular for doing black music. I thought Baz Luhrmann just great music choice all throughout this movie.
Yeah, I think the music choice, the fact that he used not just music from Elvis and Elvis's time, but he used contemporary stuff from now. I think that, and from, like you said, Britney Spears is not like a contemporary artist, but it's a totally different era. And I think that adds to this where it feels, you could say it's just a generic biopic because sometimes like the plot beats are very simple. You know exactly what you're going to get if you just look at the narrative on paper. I think it's very predictable and that could be a knock on it. You're never really going to be like shocked or surprised by the narrative. But I think, like you mentioned, the fact that the music is from across all times, I think adds to the fact that this is not necessarily just about this one story. It's kind of a proverb for the music industry as a whole and for entertainment as a whole, and how dangerous it is for entertainment to be so consumptive and so idolistic, and we don't really think about the humanity behind the people that we see on the screen and that kind of a thing. So I thought it was really great in the way that, yeah, like you said, it feels like it's a proverb for the larger music industry, Britney Spears and Eminem and all kinds of other people who have this very complex relationship with stardom and with Elvis and with history in general. I think it's a really fascinating choice to bring all those different artists in, but I think it actually adds a lot to the theme of the movie.
All right, yeah. I don't. Anything else you want to say about Elvis before we move on to our other big HBO Max drop this week?
No, I recommend it for sure, Jeff. Check it out. And if you're looking for Oscar pool, it's high on the Oscar pool, I'd imagine, so pick that one.
All right, yeah. The entertainment industry definitely loves movies about the Oscars definitely love movies about the entertainment industry, so I think that definitely gives it a leg up on some of the other movies, especially mm-hmm. when talking about a high-profile person like Elvis, and that's kind of why I'm intrigued by the upcoming Netflix movie Blonde about Marilyn Monroe. I feel like that can probably give a heavy push for some of those people working on that movie. And that brings us to our other HBO Max drop of the week. That is the third episode of House of the Dragon. And I'm all in on this show. I'm very much enjoying every minute of it. So many great fish pump moments. So many moments that are foreshadowing moments in Game of Thrones, or just foreshadowing moments later in the episode. And this is one of those shows that I feel like you watch a moment in season one, episode two, and you're like, oh, that was a cool moment, whatever, it goes completely over your head. And then we're four seasons in, whatever, and you go back, I'm gonna do a rewatch, and you're like, oh, that moment that I thought was cool or interesting, that was like foreshadowing these three other things that happened further down the line. I love this thing. Basically, there's a time jump of about 2 years since the previous episode. Daemon Targaryen's going hardcore at the Crab King,
Crab Feeder,
going hardcore at the Crab Feeder guy with Grayscale, and up in King's Landing, Rhaenyra Targaryen's basically pissed because she feels that her dad is going to name his new son as the heir to the throne, when she was like, I was the named heir, this is my throne to inherit. And she feels like her dad's just trying to pawn her off and marry her off to some Lannister. And ultimately, she realizes, or her dad confesses to her, I'm not trying to, I want you to be the next leader of Westeros, and I'm not trying to pawn you off on some Lannister. I want you to be with that Lannister because it's going to increase your standing in the realm and make you less likely to be passed over. And one thing I want to say before I kind of give you the reins on this is my favorite moment in this show is you cut to, they're going off on a hunt in honor of, I believe it's Aegon Targaryen is her brother.
Yeah, Aegon the Second.
His second name day. And they're going off on a hunt in celebration, and they find some Whiteheart deer, and it's like they've already got it tied down, and like the king Viserys is like kind of walks up, meanders to it, and like stabs it, doesn't kill it. Stabs it again and kills it. And also like the symbolism of a Targaryen with using a Lannister weapon to kill a stag, which is a symbol of the Baratheon household, because in the future the Baratheons using the Lannisters are going to take down the Targaryens. So that's kind of a little bit of foreshadowing there. But you cut to that moment. Next scene you see is Rhaenyra and the member of the Kingsguard she's with get attacked by a hog. And no hesitation, nothing. She just murders the hog by herself, which probably, in general, a lot harder to kill than a stag. And I think everyone there knows when they come back with the stag, like, what went down. But when you see Rhaenyra come back dragging the, covered in blood, dragging the hog back, they all know. They all know what happened. They all know what went down. And I definitely feel like it will elevate her standing as far as respect. But Tristan, I talked enough. I will turn the reins over to you.
Yeah, very good episode. If the first two episodes were them kind of setting the table, this is them all sitting at the table waiting for somebody to come flip it over. You know, we have the characters in set. We kind of see what everybody's motivations are. And yeah, Rhaenyra is now at a point where she's like, look, you told me I'm going to be the queen. I kind of want to be the queen. And Daemon's at a point where he's proven himself in this war against the Crab Feeder. And he's ready to maybe declare himself ready to say that I should be king. And we now have this newborn Aegon the Second, who people are kind of assuming, look, you have a firstborn king, the great council. We just declared in the big prologue of the show, you got to pick a man if the man is there. So why are you not picking the man? And we already see the kind of different claims brewing for who's going to be wanting to be on this throne. And I think we saw the fire here. So let's get ready to see the smoke coming next week. I think we're going to see a lot going on as now the scenes are kind of set. But I love the action in this episode. I'm curious to see how people felt about it overall, because especially in that last scene, Damon goes very much commando Arnold Schwarzenegger on these guys. You know, he's one man armying this whole entire group of crab killers, crab feeding pirates. You know, they're not real crabs, though. They're just imitation crab. I thought you would like that one, Joe.
Yeah.
Damon proved himself in his way by just going and wiping out everyone brutally, and Ray proved herself by going out and kind of strategically killing one individual thing. I think that's a interesting parallel to the characters. And yeah, you mentioned the foreshadowing of the trident with the stag and the Lannisters and the Baratheons, and I think it's also interesting the 5-year time jump, or not 5-year, 2-year time jump. It's a pretty big time jump to have in between episodes. I wonder if we're going to be continuously jumping around, because even after 2 years, we still haven't recast the two main actresses who we know have this like Schrodinger's recast coming up. I'm curious when that'll happen. But yeah, really good episode here. A lot of good action. I can't wait to see where they go next. I know generally where they go, but a lot of the stuff here was not in the books, or it's like one sentence, you know. It's like, oh, you know, Damon was out there fighting the crab feeder, you know, and they're like, oh, let's actually make that cool. Okay. So it's fun to watch this because I know kind of what happens, but in a lot of ways I'm in the same boat as you are, Joe, where I don't necessarily know how every individual episode is going to play out, you know. And for example, there's this scene with Ray and her Creston, I think is how you pronounce it. Crispin, I think is his name. His the one she picked out to be the hand, her kind of protector, you know, who's the knight that protected her. Yeah. She picked him out last episode, and clearly she has some kind of like attraction to this guy and some kind of level of interest. But when you look at the books, this is no spoiler in any way at all, because the books say that there's conflicting reports. Some people say there was romance, some people say that there wasn't, some people say it was one-sided, some people say it was the other-sided, some people say it didn't happen at all. So it's like you have this mixed bag in Fire and Blood, so I'm really excited to see how they play that out, because we're all kind of in the same boat of the will they, won't they on that relationship, even when you've read the books, because it's still kind of a will they, won't they with the context of the history. So that's been really fun to do.
Yeah, it's one of those things too, with like kind of to piggyback on what you said, is like there's a big quote with like movies and television, is it's not what it's about, it's a how it's about it. And we kind of know, I mean, people who've read Fire and Blood and know a lot more about the history of A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones than I do, know for the most part what it's about and kind of potentially where it all leads, but it's not necessarily knowledge of how they get there. Like they could legitimately find a sentence somewhere or two sentences somewhere and make an entire season out of that. So, you know, we don't really know fully how it's going to get there. And maybe they could find something that's retconnable and be like, oh, there was a sentence there, but that sentence was a lie and we're going to disregard that sentence. So, because it's all from people's point of views and people can lie, people, and if they could maybe put the character that wrote that down in the show and be like, and you could be like, oh, well, they disregarded the show, like they're going off of, or they're going away from Fire and Blood, but they bring that character back and you're like, oh, that character lied and now we know why, and you can do a whole thing with that.
Yeah, another interesting subversion is the moment here where the messenger comes and delivers a message to Damon on the battlefield that essentially says, we have backup coming to help you out, you know, we're not leaving you here. You've been out here for too many years. We're going to help you out. And it upsets Damon because he wants to prove himself. You know, he's like, look, I've been doing this. Now you're going to come save my ass and get all the glory. No, it's my battle. That was my reading of it, at least.
Yeah, and that's how it was, too. That was more like spoiler. I mean, not spoiler alert, but like he kind of committed a war crime there by false surrendering. But I think that was more him like, if I don't win the battle now, this will never be my victory. So I have to win the battle now or it's over for me. And he was kind of like, that was his last resort move. If I'm going to go in there, I'm going to commit false surrender and destroy them. And then you had the very much clear symbolism of him dragging the body of the crab feeder the similar way to his niece drag the body of the hog. So,
yeah, they're definitely paralleling those two characters a lot. Even though they're very different approaches to power, Damon is very much on the loud and aggressive side. I think that they're trying to connect these two characters on a parallel arc. And even though they seem to be on different sides, they're definitely going to be kind of the dueling dragons, I would think, at least of the first couple of episodes here. You know, it's hard to say what's coming without saying what's coming. But it's also not easy to say what's coming when you don't know the exact arcs in a lot of these characters, you know. So it's been kind of cool.
And not to dog on Lord of the Rings of Power so much, but one of the things I said is that show lacks star power in the same way that this show does. Like, this show has Matt Smith, who's an actor that maybe if you haven't seen his work, you at least know his face and you recognize him and know, like, oh, he's from Doctor Who. Matt Smith didn't say a single word this episode, and I would say without a doubt he's the MVP of this episode. And Rings of Power doesn't have a person like that, and I feel like that could ultimately be one of the failures of that show. And maybe episode three they bring in a person and they it's like a character and it's like that guy's played by Brad Pitt and everything I just said goes out the window. But
yes, I don't necessarily love being like, oh, let's compare both of the shows to each other, but when they're airing them side by side, it's like it's, you're begging us to compare them compare them to each other, you know. And I think what House of the Dragon is doing well is that it's very much focused. It's very much about this one individual family, these individual characters, and their individual journeys, you know. And I think that's helping it a lot, even though Westeros is a huge sprawling place with a lot of history, pretty much been in King's Landing this entire show so far, with a couple of scenes in Dragonstone, a couple of scenes, you know, scattered in the sea there, but it's all in the same general area. You know, they're all next to each other. Dragonstone is right next to the islands they fought over this week, right next to King's Island, King's Landing. So they're all pretty much in the same vicinity. And that helps, I think, focus it. And I really like the costumes here too. Like when they're in that 2-year name day party, and you look out in the crowd, you can see who is essentially on whose side here. You know, you have the costumes that are all kind of really dark green and black and kind of like a blue that goes to the high towers. And then you can also see kind of the black and the red that is the Targaryens. And you're seeing that right now there are these two very different families that are in this mix together, you know, and colliding but not quite together. I think that's a really telling sign of the way the Targaryen household is here, because they're not heading towards peace times here in the Targaryen and Kurian history.
No, definitely. You can definitely sense, even if you don't know anything, you can definitely sense there's some fighting about to happen.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for you, Joe, because you are the one going into this blind. So I think every week I have a couple of questions I want to ask you about how you're feeling so far right now about this series. So My general question right now is, you mentioned you can kind of get a sense that this is heading towards something more violent or something more intense, and the outcome of this and some of the bigger events have been talked about offhand in Game of Thrones in various episodes here and there, but not in a ton of detail. So my question to you right now is, where do you think this is going? What do you think the ultimate kind of overall story arc of this series is?
So it's hard for me to answer because I'm not 100% blind, because like I said a couple weeks ago, I did accidentally see a Targaryen family tree. So I didn't see some of the later branches, but I seen some very recent branches, or like as far as this show goes, like very close upcoming branches. So I know a little bit, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody else who may be watching House of the Dragon that's watching this that doesn't want to be spoiled. So I'm not going to say anything specific. So it's hard for me to say. It'd be helpful, I guess, to know how deep this show is going to go. Is this going to be a show that starts now, like kind of the fall of the Targaryen house all the way to the Mad King, like, and then his failure and the Baratheon and Robert Baratheon taking over? Like, is that their ultimate plan for this show? They're like, we want to go 7-8 seasons and we want to follow essentially this family all the way until they're no longer rulers of Westeros. Or is this more just going to be this war and we're going to have some time jumps and we're this first season is more the prologue of the war, and then seasons maybe 2, 3, and 4 are the war, and then we're pulling a Breaking Bad, we don't care if we're the number one show all time on television after 4 seasons we're out? Like, I think that's what makes it hard to predict, is I don't know what their ultimate plans are for this show.
Yeah, I will say that they talked about wanting to do this as an anthology. I think that's something the writers have been open about more so recently, and I think that is a direction they could easily go, especially now they're moving somewhat quickly through this early stuff, but not really. You know, they still have a ton, like so much plot to go through on this individual storyline, but I do think an anthology would be a good idea.
Like do the quote-unquote Dance with Dragons for these, maybe one or two seasons. Like I feel like at this point, the storyline with this story that they're doing right now has to be minimum 2 seasons. So maybe do 2 seasons, and then maybe be like, honestly, the next generation of Targaryens wasn't that interesting. We'll skip a generation and do, like, the next generation. Do 2 seasons of them, skip, do 2 generations of the next people, and go all the way to Robert's Rebellion.
And one question I also have for you, Joe. You see the sides kind of building here, and my question for you is, who do you think are going to be ultimately the people who are claiming the throne? Like, once this war gets to the point where it's heated in a hot war, not just a cold war, who do you think are going to be the ones saying, I'm the rightful person who should be in charge, make me the king or the queen, put me on the throne?
I think they're going to go 3 sides, and I think it's going to be Daemon, Rhaenyra, and Aegon are going to be the 3 ultimate sides. And I think, basically, I kind of know how it's going to resolve itself, but I'm not 100% sure. I'm honestly down for spoilers. Once this stream ends, I'm just going to ask you, because if you don't tell me, I'll just look it up myself. But I don't want to spoil it for anyone who doesn't want to know, so I'll wait till we're done recording.
And my last question for you, Joe, you painted who you think are going to be your 3 options. You are the Sim God of Westeros. You get to plop whoever you want on the Iron Throne. Who are you putting on there?
I think Rhaenyra is the rightful queen. Like, if I was, like, wanted to be a rightful and just world, I would pick Rhaenyra. But, you know, as someone who plays Crusader Kings, and I don't always pick, like, you know, if it's a game that's similar to, like, you can combine to play your own version of Game of Thrones. You can pick, you can have heirs, you can take over lands, you can do, the Game of Thrones fan in me thrives as I play Crusader Kings. And I think just I would throw the most chaos thing into the land. I think Daemon is the most, like, Aegon is also kind of, like, basically because Daemon is, like, the third most in line or third most rightful heir, so I would pick Daemon because, A, I think he's a badass. Aegon, we don't know anything about. Aegon could be, like, a douchebag loser, and I'd be like, oh, he'd be the funnest choice to pick because how would that guy be king? But Rhaenyra is the best choice, I think, at this point. I don't know how Aegon's going to turn out, but I think Daemon is the most interesting choice, I'll say.
Yeah, I'm interested in hearing that, Joe. Of course, I'm not going to say anything about what becomes of any of this, but it's curious to get a check on Joe as my kind of guinea pig of the person who's coming in fresh, who really loves Game of Thrones and has seen it a couple of times through, but has no lore knowledge at all, Joe. And my one last question for you is one that is not going to make sense this week, but might make sense by the end of the season. It's a simple question, Joe. You just got to pick if you are a green or a black.
Oh, my favorite colors are red and black, so black all the way. It's not even close. All
right, let's go with black for this week on Joe. I'm gonna say green for this week because, you know...
But I am a Slytherin,
I think
so.
The king has been remarried. The king has a new heir. And I think the rules and laws of Westeros say one thing. We'll see how we go. But as for this week, I'm going green. We'll see how this turns out as we continue the Dance of Dragons along for this season here. I like the episode, Joe. Anything you else want to say about the House of the Dragon?
No, we've been going on a while. I think we could get probably pretty much just wrap this whole episode up as far as the Hand Plus. Anything else you want to say at all before we move to our last 2 topics of the evening?
No, that's all that I've got to say.
All right, so I just want to drop that I believe next week Netflix currently has all of the Saved by the Bell library. That's the main show, the college years, everything is dropping off Netflix, I believe, around like September 14th is what I saw. So if you're a big Saved by the Bell fan and you didn't know that and you want to get some Saved by the Bell into your veins before it leaves Netflix, definitely check that out. What What did you want to recommend for people to watch before it leaves streaming?
Yeah, my leaving for this week is leaving towards the end of the month. I think it's like the 25th or something, and that's Boogie Nights. Paul Thomas Anderson, he just had Licorice Pizza last year. He's had a Phantom Thread earlier in the year. There Will Be Blood, of course, was his big, big hit. But Boogie Nights is one of his earliest movies, and I think it kind of gets overlooked a bit. I have the Blu-ray here and the DVD, so I'll be fine without being able to watch it on Netflix. But if you haven't seen it, it is a very, very funny movie from him. Not necessarily something that you would expect from him. But Mark Wahlberg is the lead, and Mark Wahlberg kind of plays this porn star. And it's about Mark Wahlberg's journey into the porn industry as this very, very goofy, kind of highly charismatic porn star, and all of the zany, weird characters he meets. If you're a fan of Paul Thomas Anderson and you've seen some of his other movies, he does a good job of like introducing zany characters for like a couple of scenes and then like not doing much with them after that. Like, he has Bradley Cooper showing up for a couple of scenes in Licorice Pizza and just being crazy and bizarre, memorable, and then never coming back again. So that's kind of his style. And this is only, I think, his second movie, so it's his chance to it was his chance to really stretch that style and find that style. So if you want to see Paul Thomas Anderson make something much more on the goofy comedy side than you might be used to seeing, it's one to check out, and it's on Netflix until the end of the month.
When you said if you're a fan of Paul Thomas Anderson, I thought you were about to say if you're a fan of porn, and now it's just
well, that too, you know, you get a nice behind the scenes look at the porn you love so much.
All right, so we covered some Hulu, Amazon Prime, Netflix, Disney Plus, HBO Max. There's also Peacock out there. There's Paramount Plus, Shudder. You can pick any one of those. Who for you won the week?
For me, I was ready to say HBO Max because House of the Dragon has been great, of course, and I was ready to claim that for the win, but I honestly think Amazon gets the win here. I think Amazon had a battle to win this week more so than the other platforms did, because their show had some negative press going into it. A lot of like negative fan energy I was getting from people online, and the fact that they managed to come out swinging and not just impress the fans, but I felt like they really hit into the mainstream. They had like a 25 million viewers, the biggest premiere viewership Amazon's ever had. They need a big hit like this. So I think Amazon won the week. They showed off their money. They really, really made a great production out of it. And they finally got themselves a big hit. They haven't had a big hit on Prime. The Boys has its niche and is popular among that niche, but it hasn't been like a ginormous mega hit. And I think just out of the gate, they've immediately proven themselves that they do have a mega hit here. They're going to be winning some awards. They're going to be having huge ratings. And they're officially a competitor in the race of streaming.
All right, I'm going to be honest with you. If I had picked first, I would have picked HBO Max. But you're talking about how it's 25 million premiere and how basically biggest premiere in Amazon history. House of the Dragon was a continuation of what we've seen before. Elvis was a movie Warner Brothers made and already dropped. Hard Knocks, probably the weakest episode of Hard Knocks in my opinion. Still very, very good. Loving it, but probably the weakest episode. With that, I think I have to also give the win to Amazon Prime for pretty much every reason you said. You convinced me. We don't know what we're going to do with this data, but I just wanted it to have. And I bring this up at the end of every episode. I don't know what it means that you won the week, but hey, congratulations, Amazon Prime. You won the week.
I'm introducing a final segment here, Joe. It's a 30-second segment called the Tubi Movie of the Week. Tubi is a free platform. You can watch movies and TV shows totally for free. So if you're broke and you want to stream something you can't stream anywhere else, download Tubi and watch Hellraiser, because Hellraiser is the Tubi movie of the week. There's going to be a remake/reboot thing of it on Hulu pretty soon. It's Halloween time, so if you want to check out some free movies, download Tubi, and the movie I recommend this week is Hellraiser. I'm going to try and recommend a movie every week, just something that's free on Tubi, so if you're broke, you can still stream something.
All right, Hellraiser, Tubi movie of the week, and with that, if there's a show, movie, or something that pops up on streaming, you want to talk about it, review it, or you think, hey, there's a streaming platform I love, there's a bunch of content on there, you aren't talking about it, let us know about it. We'll check it out. I think maybe when there's the next big Apple TV drop, we'll talk about that. I still have yet to watch Ted Lasso. I know I'm going to love it. I still haven't watched it. I need to watch
it. It's a show made for you, Joe.
When season 3 comes out, I will be prepared and I'll have watched it. And I'll probably not shut the fuck up about it when it comes out. But yeah, we will be talking about Apple TV and some of these other platforms, but we just need that big show, big thing to pop up while we're covering that week. So like I said, if there's something you want us to talk about it, tweet at us at Movie Changeup and talk to the hand. With that, without further ado, goodbye. Hey, thank you for watching the Movie Changeup podcast. We'd really appreciate if you liked, commented, subscribed, and shared us with anyone you think might be into what we're doing over here. Thank you. Have a nice day.